Why would a person want to write quotable poetry? Is it so his name someday is in Bartlett's familiar quotations? Well, that wouldn't be a good enough reason. But if our poetry is quotable, it also means it's done somebody some good. And it also means that it's probably done us some good writing it. And it'll be most fulfilling all around. And as I sat in Sister Marlene's class yesterday, I began to realize that I have seen only a sample of poetry that people love. And I should have known that before. I guess I did, but it was freshened up. One of Robert Frost's most quoted and most loved poems is Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. And a poet named Gene Little wrote a response to that poem that is equally worthy. And I would like to look at that poem together as we introduce this this workshop. It's titled Poetry's Miracle. The woods where Robert Frost drew rein to watch the snow drift down may have been felled and hauled long since to make room for a town. Here is poetry's miracle. Though the trees are gone, the woods stay lovely, dark, and deep. The snow falls on and on. The little horse still shakes his bells. And in the beginning night, a man still searches his heart for words quiet enough and white.
Yes.
I could read that every day of my life and wouldn't be tired of it. What is so wonderful about that poem? It encapsulates what we want to discuss today. Poetry's miracle that keeps the woods lovely, keeps the snow falling, keeps the bell shaking, and keeps the poet still searching for the best words. And when we are successful in our search, something's going to be quotable. Not necessarily every line in the poem, as we will discuss later, but isn't there something here that is quotable? I think nearly the whole poem. Well, we poetry lovers could spend this whole hour just talking about poems that we love. I've had my turn. I wish we had long enough time we could go around the room and you all could just put up the poem you like and read it to us the way you like to read it and tell us about it. I have a little sampling here on page one of the handout with the workshop title, Writing Quotable Poetry. And as you look over those lines, I'm sure some of those you have heard of and maybe didn't think so much of them. Maybe they didn't impress you. Not all of them, would I say, are just lovely to me, but most of them go through my mind. Most of them are quotable. I would say all of them are. And we don't have time to talk about each one in particular, but they are numbered 1 to 20, and those numbers correspond to your anthology poems. 1, 2, I didn't quite go to 20. Most of them are in the anthology, but not quite all. As far as I know, I checked every single poem that's listed here, 1 to 20, and they're all in the public domain. So if you meet a poem that's in the anthology that you never had before and I would like to copy it, they are free to be copied. But what is it in these lines that makes them quotable? Why do people like to slow down and say with emphasis, and that has made all the difference? There isn't any new vocabulary in it, no special words. The second line comes from a poem by Percy Bysshe Shelley, To a Skylark, and that's number 2 in the anthology. And even though the whole poem can be very enjoyable, one of my favorites is the last line of the second verse. Verse 2 says, he's writing about this bird addressing the skylark, higher still and higher from the earth thou springest like a cloud of fire. The blue deep thou wingest, and singing still thou soar, and soaring ever singest. Isn't that one gorgeous line? What about it is? Well, we want to look at that. Right now, we're just looking at a few samples of quotable things. Number four might strike you as the strangest one to call quotable, but how many of you are familiar with Robert Frost's poem, Brown's Descent? All right. It's so long, I put only part of it here on the anthology, but I'm going to read the part that is on the front page. As Frost did, he frequently wrote about country scenes, and this was about a man that lived on a farm that everyone could see because of how high up it was. Brown lived at such a lofty farm that everyone for miles could see his lantern when he did his chores in winter about after 3:30. And many must have seen him make his wild descent from there one night, cross lots, cross walls, cross everything, describing rings of lantern light. Between the house and barn, the gale got him by something he had on and blew him out on the icy crust that cased the world, and he was gone. Walls were all buried. Trees were few. He saw no stay unless he stove a hole in somewhere with his heel. But though repeatedly he strove and stamped and said things to himself, and sometimes something seemed to yield, he gained no foothold, but pursued his journey down from field to field. Sometimes he came with arms outspread like wings, revolving in the scene upon his longer axis, and with no small dignity of mien, and on it goes. And if you haven't met that poem, you should finish it. I just printed the first 11 verses. But those small, simple, unnoticeable words just caught my attention. Stamped and said things to himself. Can't you about hear him muttering? Gotta get that stopped! And yet, he keeps on going. I'll quote that. And the tide rises, the tide falls. How many of you like that one? That's one of Longfellow's. That's number six. But I can't keep just going on quoting things that others have done. That's enjoyable, but we want to talk about the writing of such poetry, how it's done. And I'll repeat what we heard in yesterday afternoon's poetry class. I won't teach you how. I'll talk about it. I'll look at some things that I think help. Some things that we can work at. So looking at page 2 of the main handout, we're going to consider one of the questions that was in the description on the program. What did they more than others? Why do we quote them and some other poems never even get clipped? Well, the first thing I would point out is it begins not with the writing, it begins with the thinking. They thought originally. They made artful connections that just don't dawn on some people. How many of you are familiar with Robert Frost's poem, The Tuft of Flowers, that's in the one literature book from CLP? That's an artful connection, isn't it? He went to turn the grass, he says, and the dew was gone. But he came. Turning the grass, we would say, turning the hay, raking the hay. He was doing it, seems, by hand. And somebody had been there and had mowed it in the dew before the sun came up. But now he's coming along, and later in the day, the dew was gone. And he looked for him, hoped that maybe he'd see him still sticking around the field somewhere. But he wasn't there. He had gone his way, the grass all mown, and I must be as he had been, alone. As all must be, I said, within my heart, whether they work together or apart. You really just do go through life alone. But while he said it, he noticed a butterfly fluttering around the field, and this butterfly seemed to be vaguely remembering where it had sat yesterday and was trying to find a place to sit on something that had been cut down. And then he saw a tuft of flowers beside a brook. And that tuft of flowers had been spared from the scythe. And the butterfly found that tuft of flowers. And he turned first and led my eye to look at a small tuft of, at a tall tuft of flowers. Anyway, as he considered that, then suddenly he began to think about the mower and how maybe, how's he say? I'm not sure if I have the, I don't have the thought here yet. But anyway, that tuft of flowers drew his mind back to the mower, and it says, the butterfly and I had lit upon, nevertheless, a message from the dawn, earlier in the morning when the mower was here. And it began to make me, my spirit feel linked with his, and I was glad with him, and it seems as if my work was aided by him. And when I sat down in the shade at noon, it was as if he was here with me. And then I thought about that men work together. I told him from the heart whether they work together or apart. So we're separated, and yet we're together. Now, that's an artful connection that isn't just made by seeing a pretty photograph and being inspired by it to talk about its beauty. This goes deeper than the surface. So that's what poets need to do. They think originally. They make artful connections. Even the little poem that is in Pilgrim's Progress, I forget if it's part one or part two. I think it's part two. When John Bunyan wrote about the shepherd boy, the shepherd boy had a song that began, "He that is down needs fear no fall." If you're already on the floor, you can't go any farther, right? Isn't that an artful thought? It's so simple, and yet it's sort of humorous every time I think about it. He that is down needs fear no fall. If you don't try to climb a ladder and get places high, higher than you can manage, you won't have to worry so much about descent. Well, just simple connections like that, artful, ones that think below the surface. Poems need to move through a meaningful sequence of thought, taking people places they haven't been before or haven't been so frequently, instead of just simply writing. As I said in one article I wrote, how many more poems do we need on Psalm 23? Find them all over the place. Go write something else. Write about something that is meaningful. Take a person through another passage with you. Or even Elegy in a Country Churchyard. That's a very long poem, so I put it here on two different screens. This is only part of it, but this Thomas Gray masterpiece is also a meaningful sequence of thought that is an artful connection. He didn't just go to the graveyard to hunt up history. As he was in the graveyard, he thought about that there are a lot of rude forefathers of the hamlet that are sleeping here, and they're not around at their hearth fires anymore, and their housewives aren't plying their evening cares. But he says, don't let the people that did get somewhere, the people who did become leaders in the country, the Miltons and the Cromwells and the Hamptons he talks about here, don't let those kind of people mock the useful toil of the poor that are lying here. He says, the boast of heraldry, the pomp of power, and all that beauty, all that wealth e'er gave, awaits alike the inevitable hour. The paths of glory lead but to the grave. And he put that together from thinking about tombstones and who was beneath this rumpled earth. Artful connection to teach us important truth. And poets have done that repeatedly. Let's see. It's verse 25. He goes on to imagine that someday when he dies, some hoary-headed swain may say about Thomas Gray himself, "Oft have we seen him at the peep of dawn, brushing with hasty steps the dews away to meet the sun upon the upland lawn. And the man is pictured as getting the dews out of his way as he hurries to meet the sun. And you might think, why would he have taken time to write a little detail like that? That's not even the main point. But this man is portrayed as a person caught up in his preoccupation with the dead and what they can teach us. And they even go to the detail of saying he'd come out here while the grass was still wet and be getting this dew out of his way to not hinder him. And he thought of something that's a detail and yet is very meaningful as we picture the dedication of that man to learning from the graveyard. Meaningful sequences of thought, relationships that are fresh, artful connections. The Village Blacksmith, you probably, many of you are familiar with that poem. And this poem talks about a man who is down banging on his forge week in, week out from morn to night. You can hear the bellows blow. And children come home from school and they love to watch him work. But then it switches to something outside the shop. He goes to on Sunday to the church and sits among the boys. And this tough man with large sinewy hands and muscles that are strong as iron bands gets a tear in his eye. Yes. He thinks of paradise, of his he thinks of ones in his family that have already gone there. And the poet draws a lesson of thanks to this worthy friend for the lesson that was taught. You're at your flaming forge, and at our flaming forge of life, our fortunes must be wrought, and we bang out on our anvils each burning deed and thought, just as you do in your blacksmith shop. And he draws the connection from a common thing that he maybe saw 10 times a week. And the last two verses connect this common village figure with the typical pattern of human life and what it teaches to us. So we have to begin by not just letting our minds coast as we go down the interstate. Maybe we need to get off the interstate and go about 20 miles an hour less so we can think about what we are seeing and think about what that means. All right, well, let's go on to another point. They employ, what did they more than others? Well, before we go on to the next point, I would quote something that Robert Frost said. He said, how many times it thundered before Franklin took the hint, you know, flying his kite. How many apples fell on Newton's head before he took the hint? Nature is always hinting at us. It hints over and over again, and suddenly we take the hint. Well, yeah, maybe we do if we slow down. But our culture is counterproductive to poetry production because of the speed that we've accumulated. All right, point two. What did they more than others? They employed piquant word pictures. Piquant means appealingly provocative. It makes you want to think what that means. Pleasantly pungent or tart, whether literally or figuratively. They don't content themselves with tired, stretched, irrelevant sets of words. Some of you are familiar with Longfellow's poem about the day is done. The day is done in the darkness falls from the wings of night as a feather is wafted downward from an eagle in his flight, or its flight, whichever. Just as the day comes and nobody can stop it, you can't go back to the source and get that nightfall slowed down a bit. Neither are you going to do anything about an eagle losing a feather in the sky. As surely as the one comes, the other comes. And of course, eagles and eagle feathers are special enough in thought to give it a sound of nobility. Or what about poem number 12 on your anthology? That poem I was quoting about the eagle is number 7. Look at number 12. Though the mills of God grind slowly, yet they grind exceeding small. Though with patience he stands waiting, with exactness grinds he all. You may as well not hope to be a kernel going through the mill and come out a kernel. You will be ground. The mill of God, a huge, weighty, crushing thing, inescapable fate for the grain, inescapable for us by transfer. And that is a very flavorful word picture for the retribution of God. Retribution is the title of that little poem. I have a poem that I don't have on a slide or your handout that I'd like to read to you, titled Good Hours. Think of the piquant words. Tell me one or so phrases that you remember after I'm finished reading. I had for my winter evening walk no one at all with whom to talk. But I had the cottages in a row up to their shining eyes in snow. And I thought I had the folk within. I had the sound of a violin. I had the glimpse through curtain laces of youthful forms and youthful faces. I had such company outward bound. I went till there were no cottages found. I turned and repented, but coming back, I saw no window but that was black. Over the snow, my creaking feet disturbed the slumbering village street like profanation by your leave at 10 o'clock of a winter eve. Don't those cottages, will you tell me?
Shining eyes.
Up to their shining eyes in snow. Doesn't it just make you see Kincaid's pictures? Piquant, fresh, glowing yellow panes just above the drifts. All right. On your anthology again, number 16, Wordsworth's famous poem on the daffodils. It's a delightful poem of this display of daffodils that he saw once. And then he tells us in the last verse, the next to the last verse, he says, I gazed and gazed, but little thought what wealth the show to me had brought, for oft, when on my couch I lie in vacant or in pensive mood, I'm just lying there doing nothing, they flash upon that inward eye, which is the bliss of solitude. That's why being by yourself is so nice. You can recollect something and take your good old time at it. And then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils. And this is daffodil season. We know what they do this time of the year. They wave, they bob about, and that's just what my heart is doing. Isn't that a beautiful way to encapsulate the mood? So that's what poets do more than others. They take time to produce figures of speech that are not overused. Next one. They knew when to break out of obvious art and when instead to be artful by plain talk. And Robert Frost did that in Brown's Descent. He stamped and said things to himself. He didn't try to use any fancy words there. He just was clever by being plain talking. And how to say when we should do that or not, I think we just developed it by reading others doing it. But that was the perfect time to do it. He didn't have time to get fancy when he was talking, and the poet didn't have time to get fancy when he was writing about his talking. He just said it. And most of Brown's Descent, that poem, is decorated with very down-to-earth details. And it's told in a humorous, colorful manner. And so poets sometimes do more than others by not trying to be so highfalutinly poetic all the time. Next, they judged words sensitively. One could say they had mastered the society of word rank. Words are not all equal in their connotation, their mood. There are the sublime, the grand, the ones that should be used only for certain top-tier subjects. Then there are ones that maybe don't rank as sublime, but they're more artful. They're picturesque. They should be used for the most delicate and gorgeous and delightful subjects. And then there are the standard ordinary words that sort of carry the weight of language and maybe accomplish a task of connectivity and that type of thing. And then there is the colloquial language that maybe only a niche audience will understand. I don't get very far when I try to read Scottish poems. That's a dialect, of course. That's more than just colloquialism. But there's that type of language. And then there's the crude and coarse that appears in some poetry. And even though I like this book very much, The Ode Less Traveled, it has it. It has a lot of crude, coarse language that I don't even like to let stand in the book unobliterated. It's just so crude. But in defense of the book anyway, he is a very skillful writer of poetry and has lots of good insights, so I keep the book. But anyway, there is that kind of language, and there is language that maybe is not obscene or vulgar, but it's just coarse and only fits a particular place in the poem. And so poets know that even though we have approximately a million words in the English language to choose from, there's perhaps a better one that I need to keep looking for. This doesn't quite feel like the right level. In your anthology, I have the poem of Isaac Watts, Great God, How Infinite. And nothing less than sublime words do for that kind of subject. And notice how he says, our lives through various scenes are drawn and vexed with trifling cares, while thine eternal thought moves on thine undisturbed affairs. It just sounds so grand. And what if he had said something about unchanged doings? Well, that's just not sublime enough. Mm-hmm. Undisturbed affairs, unrippled by anything that men come up with. And it's just an example of sublimity. Number five, they wrote epigrammatically. An epigram has to have a few things true of it. It needs to be concise, and it needs to be in broad language to fit many many scenes to become an epigram. It's somewhat like a proverb. It's clear and concise, often includes figurative language. Looking at the next poem up front here, the famous poem by Joaquin Miller. Not sure why it's not moving on here for me. There we go. Columbus is described down through the various verses, and perhaps you could say main character of the poem is the mate that's getting so distraught by how far they're getting from home, and the sailors are growing mutinous, and it's just getting worse and worse and worse. And the last verse says, then pale and worn, meaning the mate, he's just about to the end of himself, he kept his deck and peered through darkness. That is all that he's been seeing. Ah, that night of all dark nights. And then a speck. A light! A light! A light! A light! It grew. A starlit flag unfurled. It grew to be time's burst of dawn. And now, coming to the epigram, he gained a world. He gave that world its grandest lesson. On. Sail on. Now, it doesn't mean, of course, literally get in a sailboat. We understand that. It's written in broad enough language that you could quote that to a student that's giving up. You could quote that to yourself when you're just not sure what you're going to do tomorrow about this problem. He gave that world its grandest lesson. On, sail on, because you will get to the light after the dark. And epigrams, that's perhaps the most frequently quoted part of this poem. Not every part of the poem needs to be quotable. Let me read you another poem that is highly epigrammatical. It's another one of Robert Frost. I hope you don't get tired of that name. Nature's first green is gold, her hardest hue to hold. We're in the spring. Think of this spring green. Nature's first green is gold, her hardest hue to hold. Her early leaf's a flower, but only so an hour. Then leaf subsides to leaf. So Eden sank to grief. So dawn goes down today. Nothing gold can stay. Nothing gold can stay. It says a lot in four words. And what is the gold? You decide. Why can't it stay? You tell. But it'll fit many cases that the best is transitory. Nothing gold can stay in earth. Or the well-known poem of Robert Frost on the Road Not Taken, when he says, knowing how way leads on the way, he is stating in epigram form what we all know, that when you go somewhere, then there's somewhere else that takes you somewhere else. Knowing that way leads on to way. He said it in an epigrammatical form. Or Shakespeare's Mercy speech, it blesseth him that gives and him that takes. Simple words with the meaning packed down into a short line for us to remember. Next, they crafted lines that epitomized the dynamics of sound. They didn't just sprinkle a little alliteration here and there when they felt like it. They used so many tools of sound, and they used them and revised them until you say, I have to read this aloud. It's the sound that you want to hear. that one about singing still to soar and soaring ever singest. You have to hear the S's, and you have to hear the balance of the line, whatever it is that makes it that way. Or the repeated line in number 6, and the tide rises, the tide falls. That spondee in there emphasizes, I think, the cresting action of the waves. And the tide rises, the tide falls. Tide rise, that double accent there does something. They epitomize the dynamics of sound. They say what we need in here is 3 unaccented syllables, or what we need here is 3 accents. You perhaps are familiar with the poem James Russell Lowell's about June. What is so rare as a day in June? Then if ever come perfect days, then heaven in June, heaven tries earth if it be in tune, and over it softly her warm ear lays. Now listen, whether we look or whether we listen, we hear life murmur or see it glisten. What did he do with the sound there that is so wonderful? Anybody? Whether we look or whether we listen, we hear life murmur or see it glisten. I think it's partly in the feminine rhyme. I think it's partly the internal parallel structure. Whether we L or whether we hear L murmur. A lot of L's, the glisten and listen. Feminine rhyme tends to be feminine rhyme isn't right everywhere, but I think it emphasizes beautiful spots like that very well. And last of all, page two, perhaps most importantly of all, what they did more than others was to select topics at the core of human interest, not just descriptions of something pretty they saw. There are people who live on the top level of life and are content to talk about the weather. And then there are those who are not content with that level and see beautiful things about the rain as it drizzles down the pane, or the sound of the tires as they go through a couple inches of water, or they think about sensory ideas, or they connect them with spiritual meanings, or they do something that people really care about, who do care about life. You know, when Robert Frost wrote about the good fences make good neighbors, well, many are the people who have had fence row issues of some kind or other, who know how that can disrupt life, who know what a blessing it is to have people nice on the other side of the fence. He wrote about a subject that people care about. I suppose he had written about something related to fences, but it's only something that a fence maker would care about. We wouldn't be interested. And so when people talk about things that in general matter to people, and they do it poetically, then we quote them. On your anthology, look at number 13. Couldn't most of us raise our hands and say, yes, indeed, I think this way, that the world is too much with us. We just have that many appointments to keep, that many places to go, that many bells ringing, that many things beeping at us. The world is too much with us. He was very epigrammatic in saying that. And he wrote about a subject that, if he thought it was true back then, is even more on people's minds and hearts today as they get tired of being shoved around by society. The world is too much with us. That's a subject people will listen to you write about. Or number 18, more things are wrought by prayer than this world dreams of. Maybe you have an experience in your life that you could recall having felt the prayers of people, and you would just like to talk about it because you know there are thousands of other people who know that things get accomplished by prayer and nobody announces it. More things are wrought by prayer than this world dreams of, so pray for me. You know, that's a subject that is at the core of people's lives. And when we write about things that mean something to people, then we tend to write something that they will care enough about to quote. Now, the next page, can we do it too and how? I have a few, you could call them disclaimers here at the top, some observations. Not all good poetry must be quotable. Number one, we need some poems on subjects that are not of the keenest human interest. In other words, they may be subjects that have inspired us, and it does us good to express our hearts, but they might not be publishable, and if they are publishable, they may not be quotable. But that doesn't mean that it was pointless for us to write it. So we'll acknowledge that. Many poems of celebrated poets are enjoyable and valuable, but then only certain parts, like these last two lines. You know, when he was describing his men growing mutinous day by day and growing ghastly wan and weak, well, that, I like that. But as far as the quotable part, it'll probably be found most often at a climactic point. And so we don't really need to agonize over whether every line we write is quotable. We can't quote every poem we read anyhow. And fourthly, a realistic goal would be to craft a really quotable part as the climax or theme statement of the poem. Now, a few study activities that I'm suggesting to help us develop ability in writing this way. Back to the elegy written in a country churchyard. I have it here. Line 36, I've already pointed out as what seems to me the climax, the maxim that needs to be remembered from this poem. The paths of glory lead but to the grave. So making a big deal over the Miltons and Hamptons and Cromwells is somewhat pointless because they occupy a grave just like the village fathers that were poor. But he doesn't just tell us that right away at the beginning. Let's look a little bit at the structure. The first three verses are giving the setting. And he takes a long time doing everything he does. He spent, I didn't review very well, a number of years, I think, writing this. But he very slowly unfolds how he watches the plowman going homeward and hears the moping owl complaining to the moon. And he gets us in a mood, a rather pensive mood. And then he introduces his subject. Over there, under those elms, where the turf's heaving, the rude forefathers of the hamlet are sleeping. And then he spends the next several verses telling us about their life. The one side of humanity is being introduced, the poor, the common man. And then he launches into warning to the other side of humanity, let not ambition mock the people I've just been telling you about. And as he goes on with that warning, he tucks in his key point, that the paths of glory lead but to the grave. And then he continues on with his warning. And the last big block of verses from verse 11 to, at least most of the rest of the poem, is expanding his defense and his honor that he's feeling toward the poor countrymen. And so he waits until he has gotten us in a mood. He introduces us to the one side, and then he starts talking to the other side. And right while we are feeling the tension between the two, he tucks in his maxim that is memorable. The paths of glory lead but to the grave. And then he keeps on developing that to, we might say, polish off his theme. So we could say that a gem is worthy, if it's a gem, it's worthy of being introduced. When you visit the Smithsonian Institute to see the Hope Diamond, they don't have it right inside the door. Why would they put their best thing right there? You go and go, and after a while you notice the cluster of people, and you say, oh, that must be where that is. Well, a gem deserves introduction. It deserves a path to it. And he gave us that path. He got us in the mood. He told us the one side. He began to unfold the other side and hammered in his gem and then proved it. Well, the next one I'd like to look at is number 10 on your packet of poems. How many of you were previously familiar with this poem, Solitude? All right. Now, this poet reserved her epigram, her quotable line. There are many quotable lines, but perhaps we'd say the most quotable of the quotables until the end. It had six couplets. Laugh and the world laughs with you. Weep and you weep alone. And then there's a couplet that expands and rewords and decorates that couplet, the lines 3 and 4. Then she goes into the next couplet. Sing, and the hills will answer. Sigh, it is lost on the air. And then there's another little couplet or pair of lines that expands and reiterates that one. And so she continues through five sets. And in the last line, the last stanza, set 5 and 6 are in a different pattern. Feast and your halls are crowded. Fast and the world goes by. But then before she expands on that, she introduces another one. Succeed and give and it helps you live. But no man can help you die. Then she goes back to the feast and fast idea and expands it. There is room in the halls of pleasure for a long and lordly train. And then she comes back to the living and dying. But one by one, we must all file on through the narrow aisles of pain. And so the last two lines epigrammatize, put in epigram form, the theme by switching to the broad language of an epigram. She's not any longer talking only about feast or fast or sing or sigh, but in general, when you get to anything that's painful, you will file on through the narrow aisle of pain singly. And that fits all of them. And so she employs some metaphors. File on. Narrow aisles. And they hone that mood of solitude. Can't you just see yourself working your way down between two narrow walls? And it doesn't matter. Well, there isn't room for anybody beside you. And you can hardly even have room to turn around behind you. You are filing on alone through the narrow aisles of pain. And so she brings in the powerful metaphors, and each one of the words except one is one syllable, so that you can read it sort of marcato style. And you hit. And so there's a lot built in to the memorable, quotable lines saved for the end. This time it was that way. There are various ways that you can provide a path to your epigram. We already talked a bit about the Columbus poem, so maybe I won't take more time for that. Now, I would like to compare two poems that have the same title. Here's a poem that I came across, and I think when this workshop is over, I will probably forget it. Probably won't bother memorizing it or quoting it. It's good, it's just not best. I'd like to compare this poem with the poem titled Trees in Your Anthology, written by Joyce Kilmer. How many of you knew that was a man? All right, it was. In fact, in this book, 101 Famous Poems, it has a photo of him in a military outfit. So it sort of ruins my background feelings for the poem, but I still can enjoy the poem. All right, let's talk about trees and trees. Trees are the kindest things I know. They do no harm. They simply grow and spread a shade for sleepy cows and gather birds among their boughs. They give us fruit and leaves above and wood to make our houses of and leaves to burn on Halloween and in the spring, new buds of green. They are the first when day's begun to touch the beams of morning sun. They are the last to hold the light when evening changes into night. And when a moon floats in the sky, they hum a drowsy lullaby of sleepy children long ago. Trees are the kindest things I know. Now, if one of my students had written a poem like that, I would give them a good score. I think it is good in a variety of ways. It's just not Joyce Kilmer's Trees of Excellence. I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree. A tree whose hungry mouth is pressed against the earth's sweet-flowing breast. A tree that looks at God all day and lifts her leafy arms to pray. A tree that may, in summer, wear a nest of robins in her hair. Upon whose bosom snow has lain, who intimately lives with rain. Poems are made by fools like me, but only God can make a tree. Now, let's do a little comparison of this. Maybe we are not always objective enough when we're trying to decide whether we've written something good. And so sometimes a comparison of the good with the better is what we need to do. First of all, under letter A, Bain's poem seems written for elementary level, Kilmer's for adult. And that will, of course, require a difference in style. So we're not saying that there's something wrong here completely just because it's simpler in nature. He uses topics like lullaby and Halloween and sleepy children, whereas Kilmer's topics, tell me what some of his topics are. that might be more adult. All right. It talks about God, looking at God.
Talks about the bosom.
The bosom. Good. Good. It talks about prayer, lifting arms to pray. It talks about writing poetry. So that in itself does not make or break a poem, being elementary or adult, although I would say that a well-written adult poem is worth the children's memorizing to get them started in appreciating something that will hold barrels more of meaning later. But I think that there's still something else besides the fact that the subjects are simpler that makes his poem subordinate to Kilmer's. Notice the vocabulary, the wording. It's a child's level of complexity when he says wood to make our houses of. A house is not just wood. It's stated very simply. And he says they give us fruit. True enough, but not really so artful. They simply grow. Well, if you've ever tried to shape up a tree, that's not quite right. They do a little more than just simply grow, but he's keeping it simple. Whereas Kilmer gets into advanced concepts such as living intimately with rain. What's that mean? Or the sovereign power that is required to create a tree. All right? But simplicity versus complexity does not condemn or make a poem. So let's go on to letter B. Bain's language is simple. And his figures of speech, there are some, but they are very simple art. Whereas Kilmer's whole poem is really a personification. It's making the tree have human characteristics. And the figures of speech are rich enough that they are worth a literature class. Let's just name some of the figures of speech from the poem here on the wall. Where are some? They're here, but they're rather simple. Yes, humming a drowsy lullaby. That's personification.
Hold the light.
Hold the light, yes. All right, touch the beams. Mm-hmm. Even saying that trees are the kindest thing is personification. And they're simple. They have some enjoyableness. But once you've thought briefly about what they mean, then you know what they mean. Whereas with Joyce Kilmer's, why does he say a poem lovely as a tree? How do they come together in the mind? And you can think a long time about that and might get as many different responses as you have people in your class. How is a poem? What in a poem is lovely as in a tree is lovely? Verse 2, the personification as a nursing child, the tree against the earth, that's called, that particular figure of speech is called hyperbaton because the sweet flowing does not describe the noun after it. Sweet flowing breast means sweet flowing nourishment from the earth's breast. It's a special way of arranging it that makes it a little more succinct and maybe memorable. Or wearing a nest of robins and intimately living with rain. It hears it come. It feels it hit. It hears it drip. It cools as it evaporates. Intimately lives with rain. There is room for discussion and expansion that I think helps to make his superior. And then on the next page, Bain's poem sticks with the usual things we observe about trees, but then Kilmer's makes connections not thought of. For instance, that the vertical posture of the branches toward the sky is a sign of prayer and gazing toward God. We do normally think of shade and fruit on trees and wood to make our houses of, but we don't think of trees praying. And they don't, but the picture is beautiful. Or supporting snow on its bosom. We think of leaves and buds and catching the light of the sun, but we don't think about necessarily that it's holding snow in its bosom or on its bosom, or that it draws nourishment hungrily from the earth. Now, the last thing on this page, as an exercise that I think you would find enjoyable if you like poems and like writing poetry, take some mundane lines and try to reword them. Try to see if you can make at least one thought in it memorable. This poem, "I am my neighbor's Bible. He reads me when we meet. Today he reads me in my home. Tomorrow in the street," is a rhyme. It hardly qualifies as poetry. What could you do? There's nothing wrong with the thought. The thought is so good, it ought to be made into poetry. But it isn't there yet. So what could you do? Or the next one. "A traveler on a dusty road strewed acorns on the lea, and one took root and sprouted up and grew into a tree." Now, why would a traveler ever do that? Do you know any travelers that throw acorns out on fields as they travel? I mean, it's a preposterous thought.
Johnny Appleseed.
Oh, Johnny Appleseed. All right. All right.
The whole point of that poem, if you read the whole thing, is that people were sowing things that blessed people later.
Yes, the thought's not bad. The thought is good. But I think it's so removed from even Johnny Appleseed, who did that, probably is seldom copied today. For one thing, we don't walk on dusty roads. We zip down the road in our vehicles. So I won't be too critical of it if you like the poem, but I don't think it has quite the feeling of touching life as we experience it. Why strewing acorns on the lea? I had to look up what a lea is. It seems almost as if he was hunting for a rhyme with tree, but anyway, I rewrote it as a squirrel doing it, because I know squirrels do that kind of thing, and trees can grow from what squirrels do too, and they can have a big impact later. So I would not personally quote either one of these, but that is not saying their meaning isn't good or that they don't teach a lesson. It's just that we're looking at what it takes to be quotable. And I had some fun doing that.
Show us what to do. Tell us what you did.
Well, I did it, but I don't know if I did it right.
We'll tell you.
Okay, you tell me. Well, this last one I wrote like this. "Instinctively, industriously, November's squirrel did it. He cashed his acorn cheerfully and chuckled as he hit it. The seasons cycled. Trees appeared, by warmth and moisture bidden. Among them stood a sapling oak where once a nut had hidden." Now, I don't know if I made anything quotable or not.
Do you know the rest of that poem? Surely you do.
Yeah. Well, I don't know by memory. I have it in my book.
Putting a squirrel on there didn't ruin it, I think.
Okay.
But I really like all the stuff you've said, but this is fine.
Okay. All right. Well, you're welcome to that. That happens in literature class.
Oh, yes.
That happens.
Say that again. Instinctively, industriously.
Oh, well, you may copy it if you want to. I don't really enjoy reading my own poems in public.
I'd be horrified if I had to.
Okay. But anyway, yes? Yes, I did. I'll read it. It's
I'll read it for you.
And maybe it ruins this poem for you too, but anyway, I'll read it. We're talking about being our neighbor's Bible. "Avid readers all around me live with Bibles closed. No epistles or commandments in their hearts reposed. Simply reading from the Christians more than we've supposed." So that's my redo of them. But you could take any poem. You could take any poem that you want and that fails to make the grade in your mind and try doing that as an exercise.
I will say this is going to be.
Really enjoy.
excited.
Well, I appreciate the interest in poetry. Glad you could be here and your excuse.
Thank you.